There is a silent killer sweeping through Central America these days, and it has nothing to do with drug cartels or gang violence. It's a plant fungus known as coffee rust, or roya in Spanish. It's destroying the region's highly coveted coffee crop, causing more than $1 billion in losses and leaving hundreds of thousands unemployed. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Outside the northern Guatemalan town of Alopa, near the Honduran border, farmer Edwin Fernando Diaz Vieira stands in the middle of his tiny coffee field. He says it was his lifelong dream to own a farm here. So 10 years ago, he left for Guatemala's capital, worked the night shift at a gas station for 6 years, and came back home to plant coffee.
Bonita mi finca, esto era una finca grande.
My farm was beautiful. It was big. But 2 years after I got back, coffee rust appeared and wiped out everything.
That was 2012, and it was his first crop. The rust took it all. The fungus roared over the hillsides, covered the valleys, and clung to the slopes of Guatemala's shady volcanoes, renowned for producing some of the world's richest Arabica, the smooth-tasting beans beloved by specialty coffee brewers.
Una bomba atómica que devastó todo.
Diaz says it was like an atomic bomb went off. Wiped the whole place clean. In El Salvador, nearly three-quarters of all trees are infected with the fungus. In Costa Rica, more than 60%. And in Guatemala, coffee rust covers 70% of all trees, costing at least 100,000 jobs and a 15% drop in coffee output in just the last 2 years. Francisco Anzueto of Guatemala's coffee board, Ana Cafe, says coffee rust long has been in the region, but recently it became more aggressive.
Clima. Incremento de temperatura.
It's climate change, he says. Temperatures are up, and the fungus thrives in the heat, attacking the leaves of coffee trees, eventually choking off nutrients to the cherries that encase the beans. Most distressing is now it's hotter in the higher altitudes, where rust rarely ventured, and Guatemala's finest beans are grown. That got several producers, including Starbucks and Green Mountain, to team up with USAID. They've pooled more than $23 million to offer financing to repair crops and train farmers to fight the disease. I asked Mark Visaki, who heads USAID in Guatemala, if that's enough money.
No, it's a big problem. And if it's not crisis, it's very close to crisis.
Visaki says it will be a crisis when coffee prices spike and illegal immigration to the U.S. rises. Coffee prices are up, but mostly due to the prolonged drought in Brazil. And humanitarian organizations insist the current flood of immigrants out of Central America is not a product of rust-induced unemployment. But ask around Alopa by the Honduran border and you get a different answer. One farmer estimated that a third of the tiny town's residents are in the U.S. Jose Ramirez Mendez's house is guarded by a very skinny mud. His crop was wiped out 2 years ago by the fungus, and both he and his younger brother took off for the U.S. He got caught in Arizona and deported back.
Lo que tengo sembrado que no es la misma clase de lo que estaba.
He says now he planted a new coffee variety that is supposedly resistant to rust. His brother sends money when he can, but the family is deep in debt from the smuggler and the previously failed crop. Many farmers are turning to the new resistant plants, but the coffee quality is said to not be as good. Or they're pruning back trees with hope that new growth will improve resistance. Then there are others just getting out of the coffee business altogether. Humberto Mendez Perez digs a shallow hole, grabs a few black beans from a plastic cup, and tosses them in. He and his 7-year-old son and 10-year-old nephew do this repeatedly up a steep hillside. He lost his crop to rust last year and has to plant corn and beans if his extended family is to survive. Daniel McQuillan is an agricultural specialist with the charity CRS, Catholic Relief Services.
It's really a nightmare from an environmental perspective.
His group is trying to help coffee farmers stay in the business. They give them vegetable seeds and fruit trees that also provide shade and some protection from rust to try and diversify their incomes. And they give them loans for bigger projects. Edwin Diaz bought 100 chickens with an $800 loan from CRS. His eggs are selling like crazy. He can't keep up with demand. Once he pays off the loan, the money then goes to another farmer.
Yo ahorita ya no quiero irme solo al café.
He says he doesn't want to depend solely on coffee anymore. He, too, has planted the rust-resistant strain of coffee, but he doesn't like the lower quality. Diaz takes me over to two small plants set aside. He says that's all that remains of his fine Arabica trees. He saved them just in case one day rust is gone from Guatemala, so he'll have a supply of good seeds.
Ponerlo en un museo.
If that day doesn't come, he jokes, he'll donate the plants to a museum so people will have some way to remember Guatemala's once fine coffee. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
The nation of Argentina could default this week on billions of dollars of debt. It would be the second time Argentina has defaulted in less than 15 years. The Argentine government has been locked in a multi-year legal battle over whether it should be forced to repay two U.S. hedge funds that bought its bonds. A federal judge in New York has tried to resolve the dispute without success. To explain, we're joined now by NPR's Jim Zeroli. Jim, first of all, how much does Argentina owe these creditors?
Well, this dispute goes back more than a decade to when Argentina defaulted on some of the bonds that it had sold. Now, the government of Argentina was eventually able to reach a settlement with most of the bondholders, so they agreed to take less money. But there was this small group of holdouts who said, no, we want to be paid in full. And Argentina has been in this epic court battle with these holdouts ever since. The judge has basically sided with the holdouts all along. He says Argentina has to pay them what they owe, which is about $1.5 billion at this point.
So why not just pay $1.5 billion and move on?
Well, Argentina maintains that paying this money would end up being a lot more expensive than it seems. And that's because when it negotiated with its bondholders, it agreed to a contract. And the contract has a clause that basically says that all of the creditors have to be treated equally. In other words, if it pays some of the creditors all they're owed, then all the other creditors, you know, the ones who have already agreed to take less, they can come back and say, well, you have to pay us the same thing. And that would end up costing way more money than Argentina has at this point. Argentina has said to the judge, you know, we're willing to sit down and resolve this, but first you have to free us from this clause. And the judge has refused to do that.
So this has stretched on for years and years. Why has it been so difficult to come to an agreement?
Yeah, it is pretty amazing. I mean, you know, in the international debt market, these kinds of disputes happen sometimes. And, you know, they're almost always resolved somehow. The bonds get renegotiated. Everybody walks away, you know, not happy maybe, but pretty satisfied. But this one has just been a legal nightmare. Argentina views these holdouts, these creditors, as vultures that have swooped in to take advantage of the country's troubles. And the political rhetoric has been really fierce. Even this month, you know, as the clock has been ticking, the government has refused to sit down with the creditors and try to work out a solution. The judge appointed a mediator to try to bring everyone together. He's been meeting with them separately, but so far they have not met face to face. And the judge has expressed a lot of frustration.
What does it mean to Argentina's economy if it does go into default on these bonds?
Well, the most important thing is it will be frozen out of the debt market. It hasn't really been able to borrow since 2002. That's been okay because the economy has been pretty good for a while. But over the past few years, the economy has weakened. Inflation's pretty high, and the government needs to borrow again. And if it can't do that, it's going to make it harder for the government to pay for things. It may have to take steps to shore up its currency. That means restricting imports, and that's going to hurt companies from the U.S. and other places that sell to Argentina. So this is going to have an impact for sure.
NPR's Jim Zeroli. Jim, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Spain has finally emerged from a painful recession, though that's a little comfort for those still out of work, and especially the young. More than half of 20-somethings in Spain are unemployed, far higher than the average in the rest of Europe. From Madrid, Lauren Freire reports on what's come to be known as Spain's lost generation.
Hi, I'm Lauren.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Laura Silva Kirkpatrick is a bubbly redhead who lives with her husband Ricardo in a low-income barrio in the south of Madrid. They're 28 and 29. They graduated at the top of their college classes, but both are unemployed.
I went to college and I decided to study advertising and PR because I thought I would be good at it. I'm really creative. By the time I finished the degree is when the whole crisis began.
The only thing on offer was unpaid internships, but Laura and Ricardo had rent to pay. They both have master's degrees, but...
I couldn't find a job, and I started working selling...
Retail.
At a sporting goods store, just a three-month job over Christmas, and even that was difficult to get.
They can find thousands of people with experience, they want a person who with a degree, with experience, and talking English, and...
They can ask for whatever they want because they're going to find
Because
it.
There are a lot of people.
Neither Laura nor Ricardo can collect unemployment because they've never worked a full year, which is needed to qualify. They live off savings now, but Laura's perfect English, her mother is American, got her a teaching job for the fall. Their income will be around $15,000 a year before tax.
That's not a lot. You feel proud when you do finish high school and you get that diploma and you're accepted into college. You feel like you're in the right path to... getting somewhere, and then 5 years later, you find that you're not only you're not going to get a job. If you did, you would make less money than if you did working as a waitress or in retail. I think that's pretty much the saddest part of it, that why bother going to college at all?
A generation of Spaniards is asking just that. Ricardo recalls how 10 years ago his classmates were dropping out of high school to get rich working construction in Spain's building boom.
When they were 16 years old, they were driving BMWs, their car, you know. But now they are pretty bad. They and their fathers don't have a job.
Ricardo and Laura thought their education would help them survive the crash. But when Spain's construction bubble burst in 2008, it dragged down the entire economy. Even now that the recession is over, jobs have not bounced back. The unemployment rate for people in their 20s is near 57%.
With the boom of the economy in Spain, everybody's aspiration was, I send my kids to the university, they would get a degree. And they are going to have a fantastic life.
Francisco Belil is a Spanish executive who's worked in Germany. He wants Spanish companies to apply the German model of vocational training and make it prestigious.
Spain has many more professional people with masters than Germany. And this doesn't make any sense.
At a bar in downtown Madrid where you get free tapas with your drink, I meet up with Ramon Espina. He dropped out of a PhD program when he saw the writing on the wall and helped start the lobby group Juventud Sin Futuro, Youth Without a Future.
It's no longer what do you dream about your life. That was our problem 6-7 years ago. Now nobody thinks in terms of dreams. Everybody's thinking in terms of surviving.
Ramon is 27 and now works part-time as a telemarketer. He says Spain has broken its promise to its youth, many of whom did exactly what their guidance counselors told them. Many are now moving abroad. They represent an investment Spain made, which it's now losing.
They paid for my education a lot. In my primary education, the funding for my PhD, that's a lot of money, which is now leaving the country. And it's another country who will get the benefits because my country has no longer a project for me and for society both. And that's the drama.
Back in their apartment in the south of Madrid, Laura and Ricardo make homemade gazpacho, cold tomato soup. They go to farewell parties for friends moving abroad. They've put off having kids. They can't afford it. And they try to figure out what to do.
Study again. Change careers, study another master's, and I think it's killing time more than anything until the crisis finishes.
By then, if jobs do return to Spain, people like Laura and Ricardo, Spain's lost generation, will have missed a decade or more of work. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.